Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the purpose of art in your life? Are you drawn to works that entertain you, or do you use art to identify and explore truths in your own life? In films like Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, screenwriter Charlie Kaufman created dreamlike alternative worlds whose residents were no more surprised by the absurdities of doppelgangers and magical tunnels than by the vagaries of love, loss, and longing. Kaufman's newest project, Synecdoche, New York, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman as protagonist Caden Cotard, is about a middle-aged theater director in Schenectady, New York, who ultimately moves to the city to stage a play about his own life. The film also marks Kaufman's directorial debut, and we are delighted to have him with us to talk about it. Charlie, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
You call this a horror movie, and I love that label because the things that really keep us up at night are the kinds of things that, Caden's dealing with.
Yeah, I call it a horror movie only because it has been called a horror movie. Originally, Spike Jonze and I were asked to do a horror movie for Sony Pictures, and we kind of came up with a list of things that were really scary to us as opposed to horror movie conventions. And but I don't think it. I don't want to misdirect people and have them go thinking that it's going to be a horror movie. It's about scary things in life, but it's really just about life.
Yeah, there's not really a disturbing movie sort of label that you can add to things.
It's disturbing maybe, but it isn't. I mean, there aren't chills and thrills. There's no, you know, things jumping out behind doors or anything.
So you wrote this fully expecting that Spike Jonze would direct it, and yeah. Then he wasn't available. Was there any question in your mind that since he wasn't there, that you would be the guy to direct this?
There was no question that I wanted to be. I wasn't sure that I would get the job. I figured I'd been wanting to direct for a while, and I figured that what I didn't have in the way of experience I had in the way of understanding the material, and I also was at a point in my life where I didn't care if I failed, so that gave me kind of the wherewithal to go in and do it, knowing that it could be a disaster, but I wanted to.
Well, on several of the movies that you've written, you've been right there throughout much of the process, including post-production, which many writers don't get to do.
That's true. All of my collaborations with Spike Jonze and Michelle Gundry have been that way, and that's been great for me in a lot of ways. I mean, it's been great for me to be able to collaborate and to have a voice in the making of these movies. It's also, you know, a great learning experience in the process of making movies.
Have you thought much about how different the finished product is than it would have been if Spike had directed it?
There's no way to know. You know, I don't know. I think that the finished product is always completely different than what you could possibly anticipate when you're writing it. Even aside from those questions of who's directing it, it's like the project becomes such a collaboration, and it keeps building and building in terms of voices that it's impossible that you can anticipate it.
It's really interesting when you talk about it as a collaboration, because one of the things that I've read that you really don't like to do is to tell your audience what they should be thinking about or what they'll take from the movie once they sit down. But you do have to communicate that as the writer to a director, to your cast, to your crew, to the DP, to all the people who are involved with making the film. Is that for you sort of where the creative process ends, with communicating your vision to those individuals?
I don't think it ever ends. I think it's constantly a creative process through the very moment that you finish the movie. I mean, but there's all sorts of questions and issues that come up constantly. I guess I'm not entirely clear on the question.
Well, I'm wondering if you tell the people who are working on the film what is supposed to come of it, or if you just allow them to sort of interpret based on what's in the script, how their job should be.
The actors don't need to be involved in discussions about the philosophy or concepts. The actors are, I talk to the actors about their characters and what their characters are thinking and how their characters are interacting with other characters and what the emotions are of the scene. And in fact, I think the other stuff gets in the way of what they need to do. Those are not things that they need to think about. They're living lives within this story, and that's what they need to think about. But in terms of like the other people, the production designer and the cinematographer, those people I do talk about concepts with, but they bring their concepts to it and we have a kind of back and forth. I mean, I guess the collaboration throughout is part of the creative process, or a big part of the creative process.
Now that you have directed your own script, do you feel like you can never go back?
Go back to
letting someone else direct?
I could. I don't want to right now. I want to keep trying to do this. It's interesting for me to have that kind of control and to take something from its inception to its completion. So I could. I'm very nervous about collaborating as a writer with directors who I don't know. I feel like I've got a sort of a safety situation with Spike and Michelle, where I know that I know where I stand and I know what the interaction is going to be throughout production. I don't like people taking my stuff away from me, which happens a lot, you know, in Hollywood. And so I'd be very careful about who I went to.
How do rewrites work on a set where you're also the director?
Well, there aren't a lot of them, but they work the same way they work on the set where I'm not the director. I mean, there's a scene that there's issues about that need to be addressed, and I go and write them. You know, the difference is that if let's say Spike were directing the movie, then he and I would discuss it, and then I'd go write it. You know, now I just go write it.
I would imagine in films where everything is very linear, if a scene has to be cut, it's relatively easy to tell if the movie's going to miss too much if you take that away, or how to sort of work around that. You're holding so many threads. How do you decide if something's running long or if you really need to remove something, where to go in and take out an entire scene that you might have already shot?
Well, you have to do that all the time. I mean, movies almost always come in much longer than they can be. It's a process that happens over time with the editor, and you look at it and you feel it out. And then, you know, often people don't like certain scenes. You know, you show screenings and people react, but they're not really reacting to that. You have to keep in mind that they're not reacting necessarily to that scene. They're reacting to maybe the scenes around it. They think they're reacting to that scene. You move things around, in other words. You find different juxtapositions. Things change. And it's an evolutionary process. And I guess you eventually reach a point where you think, okay, this is as good as it's going to get, you know, and then you sort of stop.
It seems to me that there have to be two kinds of people, people who get your work and really like it and want to kind of work with it and explore it. And then there must be people who come to one of your movies and they think, what is this? I don't understand. And I'm wondering if that half of the world or third of the world or whatever it is, if they bother you.
I think it's way more than half.
That don't get it or that do get it?
That don't get it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say they don't get it, that aren't interested. I mean, you know, if you look at what movies, you know, how movies open at the box office and what movies people go to see, and then compare, you know, the box office to my movies, it's clearly a much smaller portion of the population that's interested in the kind of things that I do. I'm not mad at the people who aren't interested. I get hurt sometimes when people are mean or things that are said that are kind of in reviews that are, I think, dismissive. I don't mind if people don't like what I do. I guess the thing that I think is that, I spent 5 years on this. A lot of people worked very sincerely and very passionately on this movie. And seriously, you know, I think it deserves that the critics spend an hour thinking about it, not liking it, but thinking about it, rather than writing a snarky little nasty thing that makes them feel powerful, I guess. I don't like that in the world. But, you know, people have their interests, and I respect that.
One thing that strikes me is that the people who don't get your movies may be that portion of the world that doesn't have that problem that a lot of your characters seem to, which is being inside their own heads a lot and maybe overthinking things. And I wonder if that's where you think the divide falls.
I honestly don't think that – I'm not sure that that's a problem, and I'm not sure that anyone is excluded from that situation. I think that everybody lives a very subjective life. There's no way around it. We're inside these bodies, inside these heads. We see through these eyes. We experience things based on, you know, our biochemistry and our experience and our histories and our gender and our race, and all this stuff is very, very specific. There's no such thing as seeing the world objectively. I always come across that when I'm writing, when I'm trying to write something. I always feel the only honest thing to do would be to write from the point of view of a person, because there is no other point of view that I could possibly understand. So I don't think it's a problem that's exclusive to me or my characters. I think it's just the situation of being a human being. So to me, that makes it a universally interesting thing. But, you know, obviously it's not. And I know people have different criteria about what they want when they go to a movie. People are you know, sometimes just interested in...
Dude, where's my car?
Well, yeah, I wasn't going to think of an example. More just like, you know, it's Friday night and I'm tired and I want to laugh. And I like that. I mean, I get that. I feel like that myself a lot. So...
That's funny because I think a lot of people imagine you going home and reading Kafka and drinking black coffee and, you know, looking around for things to think about.
I mean, I've read Kafka and I've had black coffee, but I, you know, I also like to laugh and I have a pretty sort of normal life. I don't live in a garret or anything, you know.
My guest is Charlie Kaufman. His new film that he also directed as well as writing the screenplay for is called Synecdoche, New York. This film, I guess all of them do, that you've made, but this one really seems to just demand more than one viewing. There doesn't seem to be anything there by accident. There are visual things that we want to catch, but you move right past them. You don't really give us a lot of time to sort of dwell on things. Are you hoping that people will come back multiple times?
I like the idea of a movie that is different the second and third and fourth time you see it. I mean, to me, that's kind of the thing that makes the experience alive of going to the movie, as opposed to like, this is this movie, I saw it, I'll see it again, I'll have exactly the same experience. I don't think you have the same experience when you see this movie again, because there are things built into it that you can't see the first time. But you can maybe the second time when you're a little more relaxed and you know where it's going and you can sit back and you'll notice, you'll be able to look around the frame and see things or hear things in the background. You know, obviously, if you construct a movie that way, you have to construct it in such a way, or you try to construct it in such a way that people are going to want to see it a second time. You know, if you make it, you can't enjoy it unless you see it a second time. I kind of think that defeats the purpose. So I think that the movie, I don't know. I mean, obviously people have different reactions to the movie. You know, some people seem to be sort of passionately engaged and interested in this movie, and some people seem to be really angry at me for having made it, so which is fine. I just, you know, I guess the people who like it will probably want to see it again, and probably will get something more out of it.
It reminds me of when you go back to a book that you read maybe in your childhood and then your young adulthood, and things that you love you don't like as much the second time, or things that you didn't really understand you really relate to when you go back. Is there sort of an ideal, especially in a movie like this that deals with the passage of time and someone's aging and confronting all those realities, is there an ideal amount of time, you think, for the second viewing? Or maybe you have two viewings right away, but do you come back in 5 years, in 10 years?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't figured out the formula. I mean, I think that what you said is definitely true, and it's definitely a model for me. You know, I want to create something that changes with you. You know, and the movie is like, and I've said this a lot to people, is the movie is, that means what it means to you. It's yours. I've done it. I'm done. Now you interact with it how you will. And in that sense, I have had that experience often with really good books, you know, where you read something and then you read it again. And it's like, and it's completely different. Different situation. I'm hearing music. Am I being...
We're coming into the break.
Okay. I'm a little scared.
Charlie Kaufman is here. You can finish that thought.
I have... the music kind of threw me. I mean, it's just the idea that yes, a good book changes with you. And not only with your age, although that's part of it, it changes with your moods.
Charlie Kaufman is my guest. He's a screenwriter and director. The new film opens November 7th at Angelica Theaters in Plano and Dallas. It's called Synecdoche, New York. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is screenwriter and director Charlie Kaufman. His latest film is called Synecdoche, New York. It opens November 7th at Angelica Theaters in Plano and Dallas. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So your protagonist in this film, Caden, is a really interesting character because he seems to be constantly struggling to get outside of his head, to sort of fight off his own narcissism. And everything really is about what he's thinking, but he takes no pleasure in the fact that he's the center of his own world.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's hard. I mean, terms are hard. Isms are hard for me. So I don't think in terms of that. I accept that you see him as narcissistic. I wouldn't necessarily see him as narcissistic. I see him, I think, as I suggested before, as a person who is like all of us inside his own head and seeing the world in a very subjective way.
Aren't we all narcissistic?
Well, I don't know if that's what I think narcissism. I don't know if that's what I think it is. I guess if that's narcissism, yes, then we're all narcissistic. But I think you can try to reach outside yourself. I think it's a very hard thing to do. I think people fail at it a lot. I think that's, you know, the problems we have in relationships and interacting with other people and even seeing ourselves as part of a community of people, you know, as basically one thing. We're very sort of in opposition to people often in our lives. But I don't know that that's narcissism. I just think that's the sort of the physiological reality of being a being with a brain. I don't know how to get away from that.
So he gets this MacArthur Genius Grant, which is made me laugh out loud because it's just such a funny thing to have happen. But in many ways, it turns out to be like the worst thing that's ever happened to him.
Well, I guess what it is that it gave Caden and me in writing Caden an opportunity to have – give him free rein to do this project for the rest of his life without having to worry about earning a living in this reality, which is a dream reality that the MacArthur pays a lot more than it does in the real world. And so he's able to sort of keep working on this production that gets larger and larger for decades. And yeah, I thought it was funny that he would win that.
It's interesting that you look for plausibility in some things and then other elements of your films. It's really okay. And we all sort of go right along with the idea that you know, houses are perpetually on fire and things are happening that don't happen in real life.
I was in this movie and in other movies, but I think very, very pointedly in this movie, I was interested in using dream logic and dream imagery. And again, because this is from someone's point of view, I wanted to figure out a way. It's difficult in movies to have an interior existence represented. Tend to sort of use voiceover to do it. It's an easier thing in novels, and I didn't want to use voiceover this time. So I thought, well, I'll externalize his interior life, and dreams seem to be a kind of a way to do that. I mean, we do that in our dreams. We have this sort of like we suddenly exist in this very sort of symbolic, metaphorical world in our dreams, and we do accept them. You know, it's like, okay, I can fly. I didn't know that, but okay. You know, as opposed to if that happened in your waking life, it would be a bizarre thing and you'd be on the news and all that. So in that sense, I was trying to make those implausible things plausible. Yes, this character buys a house that's on fire. She buys it when it's on fire because it's cheaper when it's on fire, but it ends up burning for the rest of her life, and she lives there in a burning house for 40 years or so. I don't know. There's two levels of plausibility. There's a plausibility of events and symbols, and then there's emotional plausibility. And I think that's where I try to ground the work. I try to sort of look at these relationships, these characters, their needs, their desires, their illnesses, and make that emotionally real. And then the other stuff, because that's what your dreams do. You know, they take your real concerns and they put them in this sort of fanciful form.
It is always very real to the characters. And this film in particular, I screened it with a very, very small audience of people. And there were multiple times when people were weeping during particular scenes. Oh. And I guess it's hard to find actors who can always go along with that, who understand that although certain situations that the characters are put into are absurd, the emotions have to be entirely 100% genuine.
I think good actors know that, and I think an example of another form that utilizes that notion is comedy. You know, when you're an actor and you're in a comic scene, you're not playing the comedy. I mean, if you're good, you're playing really against the comedy. You're playing, this is a very serious situation to this person. The comedy is in how it's, in how people are watching it and how it's presented and maybe the circumstances. But the actors are acting, and I have very good actors in this movie, and we're all very clear that, you know, this is what we're going to focus on. I didn't talk about anything else with the actors other than the emotions and the dynamics between the characters. We didn't talk about the abstractions of the way the film is designed or anything like that. We talked about, okay, Caden, you know, what are his feelings for Hazel? How does he feel that his wife left him, you know, and what's happening in this scene? And so it was very grounded, and they were all completely available for that.
It must have been an exhausting project for Philip Seymour Hoffman, because he doesn't have at any time really a throwaway scene that doesn't seem to have that doesn't seem to matter, that just gets you from one place to the other, because you are so dreamlike. You go straight from the action to the action.
Yeah, it was a very difficult movie for Phil. It was there are 204 scenes in the movie, and Phil's in 202 of them, and a lot of them he's in very, very severe prosthetic makeup because he's aging, and they are very emotional. You know, the character is an unhappy person, and he's going through a lot of crises. And Phil absorbs that stuff, and you can, you know, you feel it, and you feel that weight on him and on the set and everything. And there's one scene in the movie where I think Phil was the happiest that I've ever seen him on the set, and it was there's one point in the movie where the character actually watches himself in a commercial for a chemotherapy drug, and and it's like happy people living with cancer, and so Phil is playing frisbee on a lawn with a woman, and you know, who he's supposedly in love with in the commercial. And it was like, I think it was the happiest that Phil ever was on the set, and it's the happiest that I ever was on the set, because he was happy, and it's so nice. But I thought it was kind of funny that was the circumstance.
And it's funny because it's sort of a jarring scene when you see him looking genuinely happy just in that one moment.
Well, when you first see it, you don't know what you're seeing. You don't realize it's a commercial yet. And then you see that he's watching himself in a commercial. So it is jarring, I think.
My guest is Charlie Kaufman. His new film is called Synecdoche, New York. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Shane in Denton. Hi, Shane.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
I'm a big fan of all of your movies. You're one of my favorite writers as far as screenwriting goes. I had a couple of questions. One, for this new movie, I'm a little concerned that when the movie's over, I might have kind of a bad feeling. I don't know if so far it sounds like it's not really very uplifting, but my actual question was for your movie adaptation. I was wondering how much of that was actually based on real events, like were you actually hired to adapt this book for a screenplay, or was it all purely fictional?
Yeah, well, thank you for liking my stuff. Adaptation is pretty, I mean, it's pretty close to what you saw in the movie. I was hired to do a straightforward adaptation of a book called The Orchid Thief. I kind of ran into a lot of problems trying to figure out how to do it, because there was no story in the book. Also, I started to have the issue of fictionalizing real people. It felt like an ethical thing that I didn't really want to do. So I started thinking about other ways around that. And I thought, well, if I include myself as the person writing this, then I'm kind of telling you that I'm making it up. And that gave me the permission to make up stuff, really crazy stuff about Susan Orlean and John LaRoche, and stuff that obviously isn't true in the real world. Let's see. In terms of being concerned about the other movie, I don't know what to say. I mean, I think it's an emotional movie, and it does follow a guy through his life, and there are, you know, to the end of his life. You know, I don't know what to. There's comedy in the movie. I'm not trying to convince you to go see it. I think you should go see it if you want to. I guess the thing I can say is that for me, if I feel an emotional connection to something that feels truthful in a movie, even if the movie is sad, I feel in some way, I feel kind of happy that I'm part of, that I'm recognizing someone else out there who's part of the human community, you know, that thinks similar things to me. But yeah, it's a sad movie, and it deals with illness, and it deals with, you know, getting old and all that stuff.
There's also this idea that you sort of play with, which is that we have elements of masculinity and femininity in us, despite whatever our gender might be. And there are times when Caden only really understands something when he sort of becomes a woman, when he's embodied by Diane Wiest.
Yeah. I mean, I do have that, and I do think that, and I do think, you know, growing up, there were very sort of clear divides in the world that I lived in, and I felt in a way very much a victim of that. You know, I think that people exist on a spectrum. You know, and I think that you have to kind of allow for that. And yeah, Caden does at the end, for various reasons, embody somebody else's life, and I think that part of it is to sort of is to explore that, and another part is to sort of suggest that everyone is the same. You know, we are all the same thing. We are all born as human beings, and we move towards dying as human beings, and our hurt and our loneliness and our heartbreak and our joy and all that stuff is something that we have in common and makes us kind of one thing, as opposed to so you know, when Caden is experiencing really somebody else's memories at the end of the movie, at the end of his life, and yet they overlap with his own. There are parallels, and you see those parallels that interested me. There are other issues too about being, as an old person, about being sidelined, and not in control of your existence anymore. You know, you sort of passed a point where you serve the world in the world's eyes, and you're still here. And I think it's a really devastating thing that happens to people. And I wanted to have that be part of Caden's experience, and this seemed to me to be a way to even separate him more. You know, at the same time, I'm being inclusive of a larger picture. I'm also sort of separating him from the specifics of his existence. You know, what came before it.
Hence the title.
Hence the title for a lot of reasons.
You know, it's funny because Schenectady is one of those words that the city of Schenectady is a place that a lot of people don't know how to pronounce until they've been told. did you have concerns that people wouldn't know what this word meant when you put it out there? Do you care now if people know before they go?
I don't care, to tell you the truth. And I feel like I like the title. I think the title suits the movie. I think that if you are interested in the movie and you do and you don't know what the title means, it doesn't matter. And afterwards, if you go and look it up, I think it'll give you a different way of thinking about the movie, you know, and that's kind of nice. I like movies that allow you to think about them after they're over or encourage you to think about them after they're over. And as far as, like, you know, the title not being pronounceable or whatever, I people were really against the title of my last movie and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and no one was ever going to be able to remember it. And you know what? People do. So I figure the title is as good as the movie. And if people end up being interested in this movie, then they'll be able to pronounce the title. And if they're not, then Schenectady can go back into obscurity as a word.
It's the word of the day on dictionary.com today.
I got an email telling me that, and, and there was like this thing going back and forth between our producers. Is this something we planted? And apparently not. It's a coincidence.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is screenwriter and director Charlie Kaufman. Let's go next to Mike in Dallas. Hey, Mike.
Hey. First of all, I just want to say I've loved your movies.
Thank you.
I find everything that your host mentioned, the dreamlike states and getting into someone's mind, it's just fantastic. I mean, it's just genius work.
Thank you.
And because you're so good, I hate to ask such a basic question about movie making, but my wife and I talk about this all the time, is why at the end of movies is everybody and anybody who's remotely involved in making a movie listed? I mean, there's nothing else in life where that ever happens. You know, if we buy a heart defibrillator, no one's ever mentioned about who created that.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't have any idea why that tradition started. I mean, I know certain people are named because they have to be. There's contractual reasons. It's part of the deal that they've struck with the people making the movie. other people, I guess, I mean, why I think it's a good thing is that this is an enormously collaborative effort. And it really is, you know, it's amazing how many people work on it, and it's amazing how hard people work on it, even people who've, you know, credits come much later. And I guess you don't have to stay for it. I mean, that's the thing about it. So it's kind of like it's a voluntary thing on the part of the audience. You can stay or you can leave, and people mostly do leave, and I think that that's fine too. But as far as like why it started, I don't know enough about the answer to that to be an authority.
We were talking earlier about the titles of your films, and I love the fact that throughout this one, Caden at multiple times has these eureka moments and says, I got it figured out, I have the title. And each time it is vastly different from not only what the title was before, but from what's going on in the present. And you automatically recognize that he thought he figured it out, but in fact reality has shifted again, and he's not there.
Right. Well, you know, that's the way it is. When you do a work that's trying to be inclusive of everything as it's happening, the work has to keep changing, you know, and there is no conclusion to that piece of work except your death, really. That's the only honest conclusion. And yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Caden is always sort of like going for that sort of thing to encapsulate it and never really quite, you know, finding it. And I do that. I like thinking of titles, and I do tend to think of titles through the process. I don't make a decision until the movie is done. What the title is going to be, but I do keep a list of things that interest me, and this one that's giving Caden that characteristic struck me as funny.
Well, it's funny. It's almost like coming up with baby names. You know, you have a notebook
exactly. Full
of things, and then you decide at the last moment.
Yeah, because you get tired of the one you came up first.
Right.
With, yeah.
My guest is Charlie Kaufman. We'll be back talking more about his movie Synecdoche, New York. It opens November 7th at the Angelica Theaters in Plano and Dallas. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly. A part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
My leg hurts. I wonder if it's cancer. There's a bump. I'm starting to sweat. Stop sweating. I've got to stop sweating. Can she see it dripping down my forehead? Oh, she looked at my hairline. She thinks I'm bald.
We think you're great.
Oh, wow. Thanks. That's nice to hear.
We all just loved the Malkovich script.
Thanks.
Such a unique voice. Boy, I'd love to find a portal into your brain.
Trust me, it's no fun.
So, tell me your thoughts on this crazy little project of ours.
First, I think it's a great book.
LaRoche is a fun character, isn't he?
Absolutely. And Orlean makes orchids so fascinating. Plus her musings on Florida and orchid poaching, Indians. It's great sprawling New Yorker stuff. And I'd want to remain true to that. You know, I'd want to let the movie exist rather than be artificially plot-driven.
Great. I guess I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Oh. I'm not sure I know what that means either. I just don't want to ruin it by making it a Hollywood thing, you know, like an orchid heist movie or something, you know, or changing the orchids into poppies and turning it into a movie about drug running, you know? Why can't there be a movie simply about flowers?
I guess we thought that maybe Susan, Orlean, and LaRoche could fall in love.
Okay, but I'm saying it's like I don't want to cram in sex or guns or car chases, you know, or characters, you know, learning profound life lessons or growing or coming to like each other or overcoming obstacles to succeed in the end. You know, I mean, it's the book isn't like that, and life isn't like that. You know, it just isn't. And I feel very strongly about this.
That was Nicolas Cage playing Charlie Kaufman in the film adaptation. We have the real Charlie Kaufman here, the screenwriter and director whose new film is Synecdoche, New York. It opens November 7th. I have to imagine that having played with things the way you do in your films and having put your name in there and having real people and fictional people, the world is your shrink. I wonder if that gets annoying sometimes, all the questions about, what does it say about you?
Yeah, I mean, it does. But, you know, I kind of set myself up for it. So what are you going to do? You know, it's funny listening to that clip, which I haven't heard in a long time. It's like it's almost painful for me because, you know, the guy who called before and asked how true is it? It's like that's pretty much verbatim. I mean, that question I used to get, that statement I used to get all the time. I'd love to find a portal into your brain. And I all the time answer it nervously with that response. You know, oh, it's no fun. And, you know, it's like, God, it's so awful. But yeah, people like, you know, Q&As after screenings, and they're just like, why are you so unhappy, and why do you do this if it makes you so unhappy? And it's like, well, it doesn't make me so unhappy. I like doing this. This is sort of interesting for me, and I can't really actually think of a job I'd like to do more. I get to think about things, and I get to kind of use my struggles in a creative way, in what I see as a creative way, and it's you know. But yeah, I guess, you know, people do have a right to. You know, and you know, when you read it in reviews too, like with this movie, you can understand because the character's got my name that people would say it's a stand-in for me. But, you know, with every movie, people will say, well, you know, the stand-in for Charlie Kaufman in this movie is Philip Seymour Hoffman, or the stand-in is John Cusack, or, you know, and I don't think of those characters that way. I mean, I share certain things with them, but I mean, I think that's true of any writer.
Yeah, maybe you're just the one who's honest about it.
That's how I like to think of myself. I'm the honest one.
Have you ever wanted to include something in a movie or in a scene and just not been able to figure out how to translate whatever it was that you were thinking about into something that would play properly on film?
I don't know how to answer that. I spend so much time on these things and I throw out so many ideas, and I don't know sometimes, you know, I can't go through them and say why I threw things out. I do like a challenge, and I do sort of set myself up for having to figure out things I don't know how to figure out, or I don't know how to do. So I can't think of an example of something where I just had to say, no, this is impossible. I mean, I like the idea that people, you know, for example, in adaptation, I mean, that there's no story. I mean, that to me was, yes, okay, I'm going to make a movie that's about flowers because you can't make a movie that's about flowers. And I guess ultimately I couldn't, but I sort of did. But I had to sort of, you know, but I did put myself in a very uncomfortable position and then had to kind of like fight my way out of it into a screenplay.
Well, one thing that I think works really well in Synecdoche was that this idea that the world sort of dies when we do. We all know that's not true. We all understand rationally that we're going to die, and everything will keep going without us. But I don't know how else you could sort of explain the way we all feel about that, other than the way it's done in the film.
Yeah, I don't know that. I mean, I don't know it. I think that, and based on other examples, but I don't think the world exists the way it does now when we leave it. Because again, it's the way you see the world is very specific to you, and if when you're gone, that specificity is gone. And I think that's true of everyone. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I do think about that, and I did include that in the movie, and I was interested in the idea that, you know, even just the idea of time, which is something that I was very interested in working with in this movie, and the subjectivity of time, and I you know. I wonder, and obviously I'm not the only one who wonders, if time does exist outside of the human brain. I mean, when you really try to hold on to time as a kind of as a concept outside of us, there's nothing there. I mean, you can't. I can't anyway, and I've read lots of other people trying to as well, not be able to figure out what is this thing. It's just completely elusive. So, you know, certainly the world doesn't exist without us because. This is a our brains are visually interpreting what we see. That if there's no eyes looking at the world, it doesn't. First of all, it doesn't look like anything, and second of all, it wouldn't be this. You know, that's we make this. We're humans, and we make it. Other animals make it in their own way, but only things with eyes make it this way.
You were talking about time. Do you get into that sort of like Chicks and Me Holly state of flow when you're writing, so that just hours pass and you don't even know where they've gone? Or do you feel that time passing when you're working really hard?
I feel it sometimes. I don't feel it often. Often writing is a very, very sort of, I don't want to say painful because that's not really the right word, but maybe painstaking kind of struggle for me. And sometimes I feel, you know, the opposite, that it just won't move at all. But I have felt it. And often I feel it when I'm thinking, you know, not when I'm actually writing, but when I'm thinking about ideas, I find that the time goes away just completely.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gara in McKinney. Hi, Gara.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment and a question. First, I'd just like to comment that I think your films are just absolutely beautiful visually and in the stories they tell from the character's point of view.
Thank you.
My question is, do you have any intention of writing a story with a lead character told from a point of view? And I'll take my answer up there.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
the female point of view.
A female point of view. I did one movie called Human Nature, in which the lead character is a female. Patricia Arquette plays that character. And yes, I think about it all the time. And in fact, the thing I'm working on now, I think, might have a female lead. When you're trying to write, honestly, there are things that I know more about being male, obviously. But, you know, I spend a lot of time with women, and I think a lot about women. So I feel like, and I'm very interested in them from sort of every angle, if that makes any sense, you know. So I'm thinking that it might be the next thing I do.
The women in your movies often seem to be more comfortable in their own skin than the men do. Is that a deliberate choice that you make, or is that just sort of how all the characters find their way into your movies?
I mean, the exception is really the lead character in Human Nature, who is a woman who has an unusually large amount of hair on her body, and is very uncomfortable with herself, and very embarrassed, and her life is her life is dictated by this problem that she has. I don't think it's intentional. I think that, you know, I think you, in a way, you're just kind of like, you know, vomiting yourself onto a page and sort of seeing what it is that comes, you know. And it's probably something about that feels maybe true to me, or at least in relation to me, you know, in my relation to women. So yeah, I don't know how else to answer that one.
I wonder, you know, you're very well known now, and people are excited when they know there's a new script in the works. And from what I understand, people are ripping off copies from different places and passing them around town. But I wonder how the process is different for you now of pitching an idea or a script now that people sort of know you, as opposed to when you were first out there trying to get someone to produce your idea.
Well, when I first started out of college, I mean, I couldn't get anyone to read anything, and that went on for over a decade. By the time I got into the business and I was writing situation comedies, and at that point I wrote Being John Malkovich, pitching wasn't really an issue because there was a script and people were reading it, and so I didn't have to pitch. People say, well, how did you pitch Being John Malkovich? I didn't have to. I pitched Eternal Sunshine, and people were very interested in that movie based on a pitch, which I think kind of it's sort of like, you know, I think the whole romantic, the idea of it being a romantic comedy and that sort of thing appealed to people. But that was a fairly specific pitch. The next thing I pitched was this, which was a very vague pitch, but the person was predisposed to hire me to write it and to hire Spike to direct it. So she kind of went, she said she would, you know, hire us to do whatever we wanted to do. So, yeah, that made it easier than probably it is for people who are outside.
Being John Malkovich also has all these elements of people who are obsessed I don't know if it's the idea of being famous or if somehow they think that famous people are worth more or more important or more validated. And I'm wondering now, you know, you wrote that at a time before anybody really knew who you were. And now that people can mention your name and fans of yours will go, oh, my God, Charlie Kaufman, if you have a different understanding of what that all means.
I mean, to me, the major thing I was interested in that aspect of that movie was being somebody else rather than being famous. That's the thing that kind of I felt, you know.
So it could have been anyone.
It could have been anyone. It was funny that it was Malkovich to me. And so I was writing a comedy, and this seemed like a funny sort of idea to me. But certainly it did have a lot of celebrity stuff in it. But I felt that the people online who are, you know, waiting to go be John Malkovich were not that fixated on celebrity as much as they were fixated on the fact that they didn't want to be themselves, which is a more desperate kind of, you know, thing, I think.
Well, and it's funny that they're lining up in that movie to be someone who doesn't come across as particularly happy himself.
Right.
As that fictional character, John Malkovich.
Right. He's not happy, and he's not definitely not the person that probably most people would think of wanting to be. I mean, which is, I guess, what the comedy is for me. You know, I mean, the thing that's different to me for me about celebrity now, I guess, if I were to sort of like, you know, put a name to it, is that I'm not as scared to meet famous people as I was. I was really intimidated for a very long time to meet anybody who I'd heard of. You know, it was really terrifying, and especially actors, people who I'd heard of and seen. It was like a double scary thing. So, I mean, in the last couple of years, I feel like I've kind of moved away from that, and I needed to be able to direct them. But as far as like being a celebrity myself, I don't think of myself that way, and the little I know of it, in the very limited way that I exist in that world, it's not interesting. It's not something to. It doesn't mean anything, you know. It doesn't feel like anything.
When you're in the midst of writing something new, do you have to avoid reading anything?
I avoid reading things that might be very similar. You know, that's important. But I read other things. I read things that might be helpful that are sort of, you know.
Like research?
Yeah, research. If I'm writing Eternal Sunshine, I read a lot about memory, you know. But I didn't read a book about a relationship. You know, I didn't read a novel about a man and a woman.
Because you didn't want that creeping in.
Yeah, I don't want to plagiarize.
Charlie Kaufman is a screenwriter and director. His newest film, Synecdoche, New York, opens November 7th. It's been really a pleasure, Charlie.
Oh,
thank you so much.
Me. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.